When it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and matching technology that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging to connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 75% of employers claim Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other online job sites, leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences daily. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Join today by heading to Indeed.com/podcasts9 and get a £100 sponsored job credit. That's Indeed.com/podcasts9. Terms and conditions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Thank you so much for giving us the most important thing you have, your time, as we continue to do what we always do, turn down the noise of the news cycle, get to the information that we actually need to discern the times we live in. Let's take a break from the U.S. elections and check in on our friends over in the U.K. On the 4th of July, they had themselves a general election. They've got themselves a new prime minister. They have a new party in power for the first time in 14 years. Now, we've covered this a little bit. We've had some of our great UK contributor friends on over the last few months to talk about this. Really, we've been talking about this particular election for a couple of years. We didn't know the form it would take, but for at least the last two or three years, we knew the Conservative Party was going to go down to an electoral defeat for a lot of reasons. One is just inertia of being in power for a long time, but they had issues. Boris Johnson ended really messy with a lot of scandals and a lot of problems. Whatever the hell that Liz Truss mess was that only lasted less than a head of cabbage, if you were following that on social media, that was a mess. And then Rishi Sunak came in, steadied it a little bit, but the die was cast at that point. The decline was baked into the cake. And we have a massive Labour Party win in the UK. What does that mean? Why should the US audience and the worldwide audience outside of the UK care? Well, the UK is still a very important country. It's one of America's greatest allies, and it's also a linchpin for a lot of foreign policy, whether it's European policy, international trade. A lot of the world banking goes through London. They have immigration issues with the continent right now. They are one of the key allies in things like standing up against Putin's Russia. They are very entwined on how much of an international influence China has. They had a beef with them over their Wi-Fi stuff about a year and a half ago. There's a lot of moving parts in the world, and the UK is still at the center of all of it. Domestically, the UK has a lot of interesting things going on. They've got a demographic problem. They've got immigration problems. They've got economic problems. And as we're going to talk to Jack Rowlett, our good friend, about here in a little bit, housing is a huge part of their economic problems. They've got infrastructure problems. They got very old housing. Local councils really fight the national government on things like rebuilding, building new housing, tearing down old housing, getting things up to standards. There's an infrastructure problem in the UK. The youth vote, which, let's be honest, we're a little biased. We've been talking to younger contributors in the UK, and almost all of them talk about housing and the economy and how they have a hard problems. More and more young people in the UK are having to live multi-generationally with parents and grandparents because they can't find housing, and they can't find the kind of jobs that help pay for that housing. So now, where are we? Well, Sir Keir Starmer is now the prime minister. One thing I like about the UK elections, they don't mess around. As soon as you win, you go move in, you get to work. That's a good thing. I like that. So Keir Starmer is going to take the reins. He has assembled his cabinet. He's given his first couple of speeches. And now the work begins on what he's going to do. The Conservative Party goes off to lick their wounds into the wilderness to try to figure out what went wrong. And this went epically wrong. The Conservative Party got really, really trounced electorally here. 412 seats for Labor, 121 seats for the Conservatives. The party record recorded a 200-seat jump, and its vote share only advanced a little bit. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means they were very efficient in their vote getting, but their actual popularity doesn't quite match the plurality that they have now. So there's a couple things here. We've talked about it before. 2019, when the Conservatives won a huge victory, we discussed that was a false majority. They weren't really that popular. There was just things going on. Folks gave them a chance. They didn't deliver on it, and now they've been wiped out. Labor's got the same problem. Labor's actually not this popular. The Tories were just that unpopular, and they're going to have to deliver on it. And there's some really hard things going on in England. They're going to have to deal with housing. They're going to have to deal with the economy. They're going to have to deal with immigration. They got to deal with an aging population and an aging infrastructure. The things that they're dealing with, they'll deal with in a very UK way, but these are universal principles all throughout politics. America, we're debating, guess what? Immigration, housing, economy, healthcare. We didn't really talk about the NHS that much today, but that's a big part of it as well. These things are pretty universal. If you've got a demographic problem, you're going to have to get immigration in. That causes immigration problems. Who do you immigrate in? Who do you let in? And if you don't let immigrants in, then you're going to have a demographic problem. Demographic problems and immigration problems directly affect your economy, because if you don't have growth in your population, you're not going to have growth in your economy. This is kind of basic math stuff, but then you get into the nitty-gritty of what immigrants do you let in? Where do you let them in? Where do you let them live? Where do they start changing the culture with the culture they bring? Now you're into politics. See how this stuff all goes together? You can learn a lot from our friends across the pond watching them. Some things to do, some things to not do. We were joking around online a little bit with some of our UK contributors. They're like, best government system in the world. And we were joking back with them like, yes, but you've never put a man on the moon and you don't have Waffle Houses and no Super Bowls, so you're not the best. And we can have some good-natured hitting about things like that. But they're our very good friends. They're a key ally. And a stable Britain is good for all of the world, not just America and not just the EU and not just the people of the UK. Are they going to get that? We're going to talk to Jack Rowlett about it in detail. We go for almost a little over an hour. Deep, in-depth, good stuff. No yelling, no caterwauling, no partisan politics. Just here's what happened. Here's what it means. Here's what we think is going to happen with the Keir Starmer premiership. Here's what we think the Tories are going to do now that they're going to go off, lick their wounds, and try to rebrand. What's going on with the Reform Party? Nigel Farage is finally in Parliament on the eighth try. He's going to have a much bigger platform now with an official title under his name. What does that mean? The Lib Dems have done well. The Scottish National Party pretty much had an extinction level exempt, where I had somebody privately tell me who's in Scotland, who is big on Scotland's independence. He said Scottish independence is dead for a generation. It's that bad. I'm going to ask Jack if he agrees with that. All kinds of stuff to consider here. And it's all part of having a worldwide perspective. So when we come back to domestic issues, local issues here in the U.S., we have a little bit broader perspective. Good stuff from Jack Rowlett, one of our great Young Voices UK contributor. Happy to have him. We set this up ahead of time. We wanted to wait for the election and, of course, the 4th of July holiday here. Come back on a Monday, hit it hard, go deep, really get into this. Very proud of this conversation. Think you'll learn a lot. I know I learned a lot. Jack Rowlett on Heard Tell, talking UK elections and the results right after this.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
Welcome back to Herd Tell. Okay, we haven't had our friend Jack Rowlett on, but because the UK elections happened on the 4th of July, we kind of pre-screened. It's like, let's wait a couple of days, let the dust settle on it, and then really dig into what happened. And boy, howdy, did a whole lot of stuff happen. He's a Young Voices contributor, been on the program before. You'll see him all over UK media, including things like Times Radio, GB News. You pick it. He's probably on it. Jack Rowlett, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Good to be back.
Love having you back, my friend. We got plenty to talk about, but let's just start with the top line item because that's where everybody else has kind of started. The numbers pop out at you, 412 seats, 411, not counting the speakership. This is a massive number. You know, 60% of the conservatives got wiped out. It looks historic, but one of those things that kind of struck me, and one of the Times Radio commenter, right as the exit polls came out, which can you all send us those accurate exit polls because ours are always way off. That would be really nice. I thought it was a really insightful comment. They said, look, right now, tonight, on paper, this is a transformational election. But come Monday, this is going to be a transactional election. Can they do it? Does that seem like a good way to frame this? It's a really big win. There's no denying that. But there's some definite results that are expected out of this really big win. And they're going to be expected pretty soon.
Yeah, see, I think it's sort of the other way around. It's almost like a transactional election that's resulted in a transformational outcome. Because actually, if we look at this campaign, a lot of it's been quite negative campaigning. It's been quite focused on pragmatic, you know, vote for Labour to get the Tories out or vote for the Lib Dems in your constituency if they're the second place party. Actually, it has been quite transactional and people just wanting to get rid of the Conservatives because they've been in power for 14 years and things haven't been so great over here. But actually, that kind of disguises the fact that Labour's policy platform is pretty radical. You know, on planning reform, you know, they're going to rip up all the rules and, you know, overrule local opposition to building stuff like data centres, railways, energy infrastructure and housing. They're going to nationalize the railways. They're going to bring in a nationalized form of energy company as well. So there's a real transformation in terms of the state's relationship with the economy. And I think over the course of the election campaign, we kind of haven't seen those ideas tested very much because the Tories have just been so unpopular that the focus has really been on just getting them out of office. So yeah, I think it's the other way around. I think it is going to be a transformation, and I'm not sure if it's necessarily going to be what people expect. I think Keir Starmer is going to be a much more radical prime minister than people are expecting.
Since you brought it up, just give me the ratio here. How much of this was a Labour win and how much of it was the Tories? Just look, some of it's inertia. You're in power 14 years. Trees don't grow to the sky. You're going to come out of power at some point. So there was a lot of inertia here as well, but it's been a mess. You know, you had the Liz stuff. You know, Rishi Sunak just kind of got on the tail end of it, but couldn't really do anything with it. You had the Boris controversies. Give me the ratio, do you think? Because Keir Starmer did what a good politician should be doing. He presented stable, he presented mature, he presented, look, we're not going to rock the boat too much. This is what he presented. I know we're going to talk about policies in a minute. He just kind of stayed out of the way and let the conservatives kind of, you know, destroy themselves in this election. Give me the ratio. How much of this is Labour rising up? How much of this was just folks needed the Tories out and wanted something different?
Well, I think it is mostly wanting the Tories out. And certainly if you look at the figures, I mean, the Tory vote share is down about 20 percentage points on 2019. Labour's vote share is up only about 1 percentage point. So they won 34% of the vote in this election. That's actually the lowest share of the vote that any party in the UK has ever won a majority on, period. Never mind a landslide election victory. So I think just looking at it that way, you have to say it's more of a Tory defeat than a Labour win. And certainly if you look at Reform UK, this third party that's come through in the United Kingdom and taken an enormous amount of votes off the Tories, they've really cleared the way for Labour to come through the middle and win. But I think what Labour have done really well is, as you say, Keir Starmer's presented the change. He's transformed the image of the Labour Party, and he's made them much more approachable and much more, you know, people don't fear the Labour Party anymore. In 2015, 2017 and 2019, the Tories ran these campaigns of trying to make people fear the Labour Party and saying, you've got to turn out and vote for the Conservatives because we can't trust Labour with the economy, with national security, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, this time, they've tried to run the same campaign again, and it just hasn't worked because people aren't afraid of Keir Starmer. And I think also, it is true that whilst Labour's vote share is only up a little bit on 2019, actually, what Keir Starmer has been able to do is he's been able to win votes in the right places in a way that, say, Jeremy Corbyn couldn't. So although Labour haven't, there are lots of people who voted Labour in previous elections who actually haven't voted Labour in this election. They've gone to the Greens maybe, or they've tactically voted for the Lib Dems, or they've voted for independent candidates. Actually, Labour have won over new voters in the suburbs, in commuter towns, in places that they really needed to win. So their vote share has become much more efficient, if you like, which is really important under our electoral system. So it is a mixture of both. I would say it's more the Tories losing, but actually it is still a big achievement for Keir Starmer and the Labour Party too.
Yeah, it's funny you use the word efficient. Jack Rowlett joining us. The efficient campaigning, the competent, competent campaigning. Even a lot of the Conservatives that we've talked to over the last year or two, as Keir Starmer was kind of waiting for the Conservative Party to, you know, they all say kind of the same thing. Like, we know he can competently do the job. He's not incompetent. He doesn't have a bunch of skeletons in the closet. We trust him with the nukes. We trust, you know, nobody was scared of him. That competency thing is a big part of this, because when you have a economic dominated election where you have a lot of uncertainty versus, you know, you're comfortable, that goes beyond just policy stuff. That usually wins in politics. Is that a big portion of what you see happened here?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at the past 5 years, if you look at just how incompetent the Conservatives have been, and particularly, as you mentioned, the economy, the Conservatives have handled economic policy appallingly. We had the disastrous mini budget with Liz Truss a couple of years ago. You know, they haven't built enough housing. The tax burden has risen to a record high. And this sort of stuff is why people vote Conservative. They vote Conservative because they're traditionally trusted on the economy. They traditionally have this reputation for managing the economy well. So once you blow up your reputation on your most important issue that people associate with your party, you're done. And that doesn't happen very often. And so Keir Starmer's really been able to come through the middle. I mean, he's been lucky in a lot of ways. I don't think anyone would have really said in 2019 that he would be able to do this in 2024. There has been a lot of luck involved as well. But the qualities and attributes that he has have also really made it possible.
Jack Rowlett joining us. Let's dig into the numbers a little bit. This is going to be infinitely compared to 2019 over and over again, because that was kind of the last, I don't know if you use the term wave elections, but I think landslide gets into subjective territory. So let's just say really big swings, right? This is going to get compared to 2019. They've talked endlessly, and it came from 2019 a lot, this red wall stuff. This is one of those areas you were just talking about, the efficiency of the voting they really cut into. This is stuff that was Labour, went Conservative, now it's gone back to Labour. This has more than just electorally with, you know, the amount of seats. This has kind of rewritten part of the map, this swing back and forth over the last few years since 2019. Do we need a change in terminology? Is this that, you know, transactional we were talking about? Are these kind of midland, northern places that were traditionally one way, then swing back again? How do we kind of approach that? Because that seems like if you start looking ahead to the next election and how Labour is going to hold on to this majority, we'll talk about that in a minute. Do they need to change the terminology of things like the red wall? Do they need to look at the actual electoral map a little bit? Because Labour, they struggled in inner cities, which is usually kind of a place where they usually do really well. There's some really interesting little tidbits in here that maybe we need to kind of change our terminology. What do you think?
Well, I think what's the phenomenon is that across the board, the British electorate has become much swingier. They're just much more willing to vote for different parties at different elections. They're not, they don't identify with parties in the same way that they did 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so actually the red wall, you know, Labour have won the red wall back at this election, but it's still pretty marginal. Like they're nowhere near as far ahead in the red wall at this election as they were in 2017 or 2015 before they lost it in the first place. And as you say, in the inner cities as well, Labour's vote share has fallen, particularly to parties like the Greens and independent candidates. A lot of that is I think more specifically down to the issue of Gaza, which has motivated a lot of young voters and a lot of Muslim voters in the UK who are disproportionately in the inner cities of Britain. And I think it's going to be a big challenge for Labour to hold on to the electoral coalition they built in 2029. And actually, as much as we look at this and say the Tories have been utterly decimated, and if you saw this sort of result, you know, 25 years ago under Tony Blair, very similar number of seats for Labour and the Tories back then in 1997, and the Tories were out of power for a generation. But actually, the British electorate is so volatile now, there's this complete lack of partisan identity anymore, that it's completely plausible that the Tories could be back in office in 2029 and it could be Labour losing by a landslide.
You use the term swingingly. I don't know if that's proper English or not, but you're properly English, so we'll just accept it. But I think it's a perfect term for what we're looking, because over and over and over again, I was listening to these results. Of course, the time difference, so it was late afternoon, early evening here as we started hearing the results. People just kept talking about that 2019 election, and especially the Labour folks. You know, they're elated. They're excited. They're all like, I had no idea this would happen this soon. We thought we were in a 10 to 15 year cycle where it would take to come back. The Labour folks were excited, and give, you know, Keir Starmer and Labour credit, because they cleaned house and straightened some things up, and they got the job done. You can't argue with the scoreboard. However, one of those lessons of that 2019 election was the Conservatives won that huge win with kind of a false, and I hate to use false because they did win it, but they kind of had a false constituency that they won that election with, and they quickly lost it because of the scandals, because of things that happened, because of Boris, because of Liz, and so on and so forth. All the things you've already listened. Isn't one of the lessons here for Labour is like, hey, this is not a natural this is not a natural constituency you've put together to win this election. How are they going to hold on to it? Because there's no way they can actually hold on to all of this. How do they hold on to at least a governing majority over the next 2, 3, 4 years going into whatever is going to be the next general election?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. And that was the big problem for the Tories in 2019, is they built an electoral coalition that was innately unsustainable. I think the difference under the Tories was that we didn't see any economic growth in real terms. And I think what Labour's saying is that they're going to really push for growth. That's the biggest issue for them, is they need to get the economy growing. They need to get productivity growing in the UK, which has remained stagnant for so long. And actually, that's how they keep that coalition together and potentially build it out further, because economic growth is the great uniter. It brings people together. Governments that grow the economy don't tend to lose elections. And I think that's still true now, no matter how volatile the electorate is. And Labour's hitting the ground running with planning reform this week. And that's really at the center of their drive for economic growth. So whilst they might annoy some parts of their coalition by, for example, building loads of housing or infrastructure, I think overall they will probably gain more votes than they lose if they really can do what they're saying they're going to do and get the economy growing again. Because if you look in, although the Tories like to say that the UK has the fastest growth rates in the G7, that was their economic legacy. Actually, if you look at the per capita figures, because immigration into the UK has been so high, and because the supply of housing and access to public services has been so restricted, actually per capita GDP has shrunk for most of the quarters since the COVID pandemic. So we are still much, much poorer in real terms than we were before COVID. That's what Labour needs to solve. If they solve that, they get re-elected. If they don't, they will lose power in a very similar manner to how the Tories have lost power at this election, I think.
Jack Rowley, Young Voices UK, joining us. Let's dig into it, because really the two issues, besides, you know, conservative incompetence and that sort of thing, the real two issues of this election was economics, specifically housing, and immigration. Let's do the housing part first. As we're recording this, Rachel Reeves, the new chancellor, was actually speaking earlier today, laid out their program. They're going to force this building of housing. I know this is something that you particularly focus on, so I want to ask you, walk us through it, especially an American audience, an international audience that isn't really familiar. She's using a lot of language that's a little bit loaded. She's talking about, well, the last 14 years, there's been this refusal to, this is a quote, refusal to confront the tough and responsible decisions. If you're going to build housing, you got to deal with locals. If you're the chancellor, a national figure, telling the locals where and how to build housing is going to be politically fraught. They've actually openly said that, like, look, there's going to be political pain here. This is a very classic fight, regardless of your, you know, political system, whether it's parliamentary system, American system, whatever. We need to build more houses. The locals don't want it. The federal government wants to build it. The national government in the UK say that's really going to be the heart of whether this housing piece of this gets built, is that fight. Is that a fair way to lay it out?
Yeah, I think it is. I think one important point, though, is that actually, as volatile as the Labour electoral coalition is, as we've just talked about, one potential strand that does run through that 34% of the electorate that voted Labour is they're much more likely to be renting housing. They're much less likely to own a home than the Tory electoral coalition was at the last election. That was actually the thing that united Tory voters in 2019, was they were much more likely to be homeowners. And so actually, it's in the incentive of the Labour Party to build these homes, because that's the thing that will deliver for their voter coalition. So I think it's in a way, it's easier for Labour to make these choices than it was for the Tories, because the Tories were primarily, their base of support was amongst older voters who own their own homes. And so when the Tories were building, were trying to reform planning, as they tried to do in 2021, they were coming up against a lot of opposition. And even though Labour has won a lot of those same seats where a lot of that opposition was concentrated, if you break it down and you look at the voters in those seats, the people who voted Labour are people who are much more likely to be renters, who really want new housing to be built and need new housing to be built. And actually, this is a phenomenon that's kind of occurred over the past couple of electoral cycles, is you have lots of younger renters who lived in inner cities and have been priced out of the inner cities. They've had to move to the suburbs and commuter towns because those are the only places they can afford to rent. And so there's been a bit of electoral churn. You've seen these younger voters move out to the suburbs, which traditionally vote Tory, and then suddenly it's been easier for Labour to win those seats. So I think there is this strand that runs through the Labour electoral coalition. And I hope, but I also think that Labour will follow through on their pledges on housing and planning more generally. And as you say, that's what Rachel Reeves is doing this week. We've seen housing targets come back, and the National Planning Policy Framework is going to be put forth before Parliament rises for the summer recess in August.
Yeah, the other thing she talked about was big infrastructure building. Look, this is another classical political debate and policy debate. Big infrastructure is usually politically good because people see stuff being built. They see roads improving. They see housing going up. The political fraught part of that is twofold. As one is, sometimes you got to overrun local people to get that stuff built, especially in the UK system with red tape and local councils and so on and so forth. The other part of that, though, is that takes a lot of money. When you got into power on a fraud economy and you're talking about spending a whole lot of money, you're going to have to find the money to do that somewhere. How do they navigate that particular choppy bit of water?
Well, I think the thing is that every policymaker in Britain, deep down, every analyst knows that planning reform and a lack of investment in infrastructure are the big things that have been holding the UK economy back. So I think it will be much easier for Labour to borrow money for capital investment in that way, to fund the building of infrastructure, much easier for Labour to borrow for that than, say, it was for the Tories to try and borrow for unfunded tax cuts back in 2022 under Liz Truss. So I'm not sure it is going to be so much of a problem, so long as they can really make the case that we're only borrowing this money to invest in infrastructure, and that's going to grow the economy in the medium term. And I think also what's really important is they're doing it straight away. This is very much the focus now, because actually it might cause some unrest if you're building big infrastructure projects. It might mean that Labour lose a bunch of seats at local elections in the UK over the next couple of years. But in 5 years' time, by the time it gets to 2029, you're starting to see the results. As you say, people can see the new roads, they can see the new railways, they can see the new houses, and they're also experiencing the economic growth benefits that go along with building those things. And that's the point when they're making their decision as to who they're going to vote for. So whilst Labour's popularity may tank in the short term as a result of some of these measures, actually in the medium term, I think it's by far the best thing for their electoral prospects.
And this feeds back into where we started with a transactional election. If you're going to have a transactional election, you got to deliver on some stuff. Building stuff shows up a lot faster than, you know, monetary policy where you're fiddling with the interest rates or something like that, right?
Absolutely. And Britain really hasn't built anything in such a long time. It's hard to, you can't overstate the scale of the lack of building that the UK has had. We're currently, this summer, we're having to release prisoners halfway through their sentences because we haven't built enough prisons. Because every time you try and build a prison, you run into local opposition, and the Tory government wasn't prepared to overrule that local opposition. The same with reservoirs. We haven't built a reservoir since 1987. And every summer now, with increasing temperatures, you know, villages in the UK run dry of water because our water infrastructure is creaking. So the Labour government just has to do something about it. They have to build things because the country is coming apart at the seams, and it's the only way you can fix things.
Yeah, coming apart at the seams, Jack Rowlett, you say that, but when I've talked to our UK friends over there the other day, they're talking about things that are classically Brit. This isn't just a euphemism that you're saying it's coming apart at the seams. They point to things like, you know, the classical thought people think of, like, you know, the British row houses. Well, most of those are post-World War II and haven't been really updated and or replaced, at least in enough numbers to replace them. That's the sort of real politics stuff that you're talking about, it coming across at the seams. Just walk people through that maybe aren't in the minutiae of UK politics. It's like, no, that's not us just saying stuff. There's, you know, housing, there's just not enough of it. Infrastructure, there's just not enough of it. Road, you talk about people moving out to the suburbs. UK doesn't really have the suburbs like an America or like a Germany has, where they've built it because they've had those restrictions and that red tape. Just break that down a little bit, because I hear everybody keeps saying that, but not all the audience maybe fully understands what you mean by it.
Yeah, so in the UK, the average house now costs 10 times the average annual income. So housing is totally unaffordable. An increasing number of people are renting. The most common living arrangement for a 30-year-old in the UK is with their parents. Whereas if you look at the baby boomer generation, for example, the most common living arrangement for 30-year-olds was living in their own home. Our railways are massively expensive and subject to an enormous number of cancellations. Our roads are crumbling and falling apart. Our hospitals have leaky roofs. Our schools, you know, the same thing. And, you know, it's also the case, coming back to housing, you mentioned those terrace houses and the fact that we haven't replaced our existing stock. That's really true. And actually, the UK's housing is not just expensive. The housing that we do have is both smaller and of a lower quality than in comparable countries like Germany, France, Italy, the United States, etc. We are the worst in the OECD for affordability of housing and the second worst for quality. So it's just an unbelievable crisis. And you have people in the UK who have what you would think are good jobs. You know, they work maybe in government, for example, or they work for banks, or they work, you know, at newspapers. You know, jobs that you would say are proper, you know, middle class in the British sense. You know, good jobs for well educated people, and they just can't afford housing. Like even the idea of being able to afford your own house is just totally alien, because the shortage is so bad. It's really, you cannot overstate how bad this problem is in the UK, and I think it's unimaginable for people in other developed nations to kind of look at Britain and see how bad it's got, because it just conjures the question, why would you let it get this bad in the first place?
Yeah, Jack Rowlett joining us. It's funny you say that, because I was talking to one of our friends who was on staff for an MP who got voted out, and the first thing they said was, man, I don't have to do that commute anymore. And a lot of that age group, because, you know, staffers are 20, 30 years old usually, like just the brutal commutes on that stuff. Is this sort of thing, you're talking about the housing situation, living multi-generationally, that sort of stuff, this is driving into the generation gap in UK politics. The youth vote was kind of all over the map when you really dig into the demographics of this. They're not consolidated on any one party. What does that tell you? Is that just a measurement of discontentment, of disillusion? Voter turnout was actually not all that high. It's going to wind up being in the 60s somewhere, even with all the hype of this election. Do you chalk that up to disillusionment? Youth votes always low anywhere, but they're really getting hammered in the UK. A lot of them are going abroad for work now, that sort of thing, if they're capable to do it, or they're just not working and living at home. This is a huge problem. How do you think that reflected in these elections, or has it not reflected yet and it's going to build and start reflecting going forward?
Well, I think, yeah, there's a massive amount of disillusionment. And whilst you're absolutely right that the youth vote was all over the place, the one place it wasn't was for the Tory party. And if you go back to 2010, when the Conservatives first entered power, even among the youngest voters, so the under 24-year-olds, the Tories were only one percentage point behind. At this election, among under 35s, the Tories finished fifth and they got 6% of the votes. So the youth vote has been totally disillusioned with the government. I think they're not massively persuaded by the Labour Party in a lot of cases. And I think part of the reason why that's the case is, although Labour has this quite radical policy on planning reform and getting stuff built, they haven't really put that at the center of their general election campaign. They kind of kept fairly quiet about it, I think, to avoid startling the horses and upsetting people in the suburbs and, you know, homeowners in the constituencies that Labour was trying to win. And also, we've got these issues of Gaza, which I know has motivated a lot of young people as well, and they're quite discontented with the stance of the Labour Party on that. And also concern about the environment as well, and that's driven a lot of support for the Green Party. So I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction among young people, a lot of disengagement with politics, and also among young men. Interestingly, Reform UK, this right wing party that's broken through at this election, they've actually won quite a bit of support with young men in the UK as well. Partially because they've got such a good game on social media sites like TikTok. So I think we are witnessing a transformation in how young people vote, because at previous elections, they've been very much in the Labour column. At this election, that's broken down. And I think really young people are sort of any parties to win at the next election. And, you know, if Labour do sort out planning reform and get Britain building, they may well win young people back over. But if they don't, then young people could keep spreading to the Greens and Reform UK.
Jack Rowlett from Young Voices UK joining us. Let's get to immigration, because that's the other big thread through a lot of this stuff. I don't even know where to really start with the immigration thing, because it's really, really loud in the press. It's obviously been a big deal in the polls. Let's just start with where we're at. Yvette Cooper is going to be the new Home Secretary. She had some very interesting things to say when she was the shadow secretary. I love the fact you have shadow secretaries that get the comments like, okay, well, you said all this, now you're in charge, see what you do with it. Labor did they hit the layup, if you want to use a basketball term, right? They got the gimme. They got rid of the Rwanda policy, which is one of the most mad things I've ever heard in my life. Like, did anybody – that wasn't good on optics, Paul. Like, who thought this was a good idea? So they got the automatic layup of getting rid of that. Past that, though, what are they going to do here? Because we just talked about this coalition they've put together. All those center-right, maybe kind of centrist voters, those voters all are really watching the immigration piece of this as much as the economic. You want to lose a whole lot of them in a hurry, mess up the immigration question, because that is foremost in a lot of people's minds. Yeah,
absolutely. So what the kind of centerpiece of Labour strategy on immigration is, that they're going to massively boost the number of people working for the border force. They're going to have a new strategy on that to stop those small boats coming over from France to the UK. So these asylum seekers, in a lot of cases, that's been a highly salient issue in the UK. And they're going to use anti-terror laws to try and crack down on the criminal gangs that are smuggling people across the channel. There's also talk that they might, increase the number of legal routes for people to apply for asylum in the UK. One of the insane things about the UK immigration system is that if you're trying to get here as a refugee, you have to come to the UK first before you can apply for asylum status, unless you're in a very niche case, like you're from Ukraine, for example. And so people are incentivized to cross the channel to smuggle themselves across into the UK. If you let them apply from their own countries, then you can say, well, anyone coming across the channel definitely doesn't have, or is very unlikely to have, a legitimate claim to asylum in the UK, because they would have applied from their own country if they did. So Labour is approaching it much more pragmatically. They're going to crack down on these criminal gangs. They're going to have more legal routes, and they're going to increase the number of staff processing these asylum claims as well. But there hasn't been that much talk about legal migration. And that's the other big issue here. And that's driven a lot of the reform support. The UK has well over 500,000 people coming every year entirely legally. And the government, the Tory government, consistently said it wanted to reduce that number to the tens of thousands. It never managed it. And Labour's now promising to reduce immigration as well. They don't really seem to have any real strategy on how to deliver that. And I think the big problem with the issue of immigration in the UK is that both sides approach it with magical thinking. You have the side of Nigel Farage, Reform UK, and parts of the Tory party who say, oh, well, we need net zero immigration. We need to cut it down to zero. We need to stop people from coming here at all. We don't need people from other countries. And it's making our housing crisis, et cetera, worse. And you have the other side of the argument who say, oh, well, no, that's not a problem. We should let people keep coming here. There are no issues with integration at all. There are no issues with our, you know, housing supply. It doesn't make that worse. And let's just let anybody who wants to come here, come here. And actually, what we need is that middle ground of saying, we have an aging society. We need to broaden our tax base. And we want to attract the best and brightest from around the world. So let's let people come. But also, we need to have a strategy on integration, and we need to be increasing the supply of our housing and increasing the supply of our public services as well, so that we can meet that demand. You can't pretend either way. We really need to make immigration work, if you like.
Jack Rowley joining us. The UK population projections, which are always, you know, taken with some grains of salt, you're talking about a growth of somewhere around 70 million in the coming decades. That's a large jump for the UK. You know, you're talking 10, 12 million more people in a short period of time. That's if you don't do anything. The real question policy-wise here for Labour, though, is what you just laid out, and that's what they've basically laid out. If you're going to do basically the same thing that the Conservatives have been doing, only you're going to smile instead of snarl, I heard one commenter place it. If you don't actually do anything very much different, I don't know that you're going to get much of a different result, and you're certainly not going to get to that middle ground because – look, immigration is one of those math problem things. If you're going to have an NHS and you're going to have an aging demographic problem in a country, you're going to need some immigration in there just to keep your tax base up. So you better decide what kind you want and try to adjust it. If you're just taking these half measure steps over and over and over again because it's politically fraught, not only are you not going to solve the problem and get to that happy middle ground where everybody succeeds, but you're going to keep feeding the extremes on both sides that are either let everybody in or don't let anybody in. They're going to get more fuel for their fire. It feels like the middle ground is really going to be hard to get to. And not only that, it's probably going to make the policy worse in the near term. Is that too harsh? Because that, I kind of see him just kind of tiptoeing around it. And I've seen it in America. You keep tiptoeing around it, you just make it worse and worse.
No, I think you're right. I think they will tiptoe around it. I think there's three main reasons for that. First, it's difficult, as you say, to the politics of this is quite difficult. Secondly, Labour support among lots of immigrant communities in the UK fell at this election. And there's a lot of talk that Labour really needs to go after those voters to win them back so that they can maintain power in 2029. And for a lot of those voters, particularly in Muslim communities in the UK, one of the most important issues, it seems, is maintaining a liberal stance on immigration and allowing more people to come to the UK. So I think that's a really big thing as well. And thirdly, although if we look at the fact that immigration has been so high and growth has been so low in real terms, because we bring people over here and that increases the number of people and therefore GDP per capita falls if you don't have economic growth growing fast enough per person. But actually the headline figures, the non-per person figures, they're just nominal figures, have grown as a result of immigration, because the more people you bring, the more demand you have, and the more the economy grows, even if it isn't actually making individual people richer. And so politicians have essentially for, and this goes under the Conservatives and the previous Labour government as well, under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, they've been addicted to a high amount of immigration to boost those top line figures for the economy. And in the short term, that can improve people's perceptions of the government because, you know, for example, you know, you can point to, oh, we've got the fastest growth in the G7. But actually, in the medium term, you do end up with worse policy because you haven't solved any of the problems. You haven't dealt with the issues of integrating people into British society or building enough supply to ensure that you can accommodate those people. You've just brought a bunch more people over and then you've made the problem even worse.
Jack Rowlett joining us here on Heard Tell. Okay, Keir Starmer is in power. One thing I like about the UK is like, all right, you got 5 minutes to move out of 10 Downing Street, get out. I like that. It's very, very fast, right? I'm exaggerating a little bit. But they immediately got his cabinet together, you know, went to the King, came back from the King, did his press conference. He's got an excellent media team because the first couple of videos have been really sharp. So that's one thing Rishi Sunak I didn't think ever did very well. He's got his cabinet together now. Any surprises, anything to pay attention to as his cabinet goes forward? We've already talked about the new chancellor. Angela Rayner is going to be the deputy. She's been a little bit of a lightning rod on certain things. Anything in this cabinet that we should pay attention to, do you think? Any surprises?
So the top line cabinet, the main cabinet positions haven't been too surprising, actually. They've mostly just been the people who were in the shadow cabinet before. But if you dig down, what is kind of a bit more surprising is that he's brought back ministers from the New Labour era. So under Tony Blair, the 90s and 2000s, he's made them peers in the House of Lords. So he's brought back Jackie Smith, who's the former Home Secretary, Alan Milburn, who's the former Health Secretary, is coming back to help reform at the NHS. And he's also brought some people from outside politics into the House of Lords to become ministers as well. So Patrick Vallance, who was our, I guess, kind of our equivalent of your Anthony Fauci during the pandemic, he's now Minister for Science. A businessman called James Timpson, who's a big campaigner for prison reform, he's coming in as Minister for Prisons. I think what this suggests is there's a slightly less ideological approach to governance under Keir Starmer, and it is more about whether they deliver or not. It's more about encouraging delivery, being pragmatic. And we have this phrase, I don't know if you have this in the US, but we have this phrase in the UK of government of all the talents, the idea of bringing people from lots of different parts of civil society, different parts of the political spectrum into the government, making them ministers. And that way you make the best policy because you're not putting party politics above everything. And that really signals a different approach for Starmer compared to the Tories before him.
And interestingly enough, and some of it's because they've been out of power for 14 years, so they didn't have an actual previous government to pull from. Look, you know, Biden's got plenty of former Obama people, right? Trump had a lot of Bush people, you know, these things that's really not the case here a lot. You've got a couple of older heads like McFadden in them, but also relatively young, a lot of middle-aged people on the top line parts of this cabinet.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of middle-aged people and a lot of state-educated people as well. So people who've been to schools run by the government rather than private schools. And it's a much more representative cabinet of normal Britain. There are far fewer people who went to Oxford and Cambridge, who went to Eton, you know, the posh private schools in the UK. We have ministers who were on free subsidized school meals when they were at school, people who've grown up in social housing in the UK. And it means, I think, they're much more likely to have a frame of reference of what life is like for normal people and to be thinking about that when they're making policy. So I think that's a pretty big thing as well.
Yeah, Jack Rowlett joining us. Okay, we've been picking on Labour a little bit because, hey, you're in charge, you're in the seat, you get the criticism, even though you haven't really done anything yet. Let's talk the Tories real quick, though. They're going to be in the wilderness for a little while here. They're going to have to read Rishi Sunak has resigned as leader, pending whoever gets to replace him. What do they do? Because if they do a Labour quick turnaround like, you know, Keir Starmer engineered, where it was about, you know, roughly 5 years and they got right back in power with a sweeping majority, if they're going to do something like that, they're going to have to rebrand. They're going to have to find some leadership. They have neither right now. What do they do? Because the danger for them is going to be look at these results and look at reform and go, okay, do we go more to the right or do we go back to the middle and try to pick off more Labour votes? This is, by the way, not an unhealthy fight. You need to do this as a political party every so often. What do you kind of see them doing as a response here? Because they're going to have to kind of figure some things out.
Yeah, so I think they're going to have a longer leadership contest than they've had previously. It seems at the moment, this could change, but at the moment, it seems like Rishi Sunak is going to stay on as acting leader for a period of time to allow the Conservative Party to have a deeper conversation about what's gone wrong at this election. But I think that they're setting themselves up to fail, because already the leadership contest hasn't even started yet. The candidates haven't formally put themselves forward, but already it's being couched in terms of the center of the party against the right of the party. Do you tap to the right to win back voters from Reform, or do you tap to the center of the party to win back voters who've gone across to Labour or the Liberal Democrats? And actually, what the Tories need to do is to find a vision that brings both of those cohorts together, because that's when the Conservatives win. That's what Boris Johnson did in 2019. He was able to unite the entire Conservative electoral coalition around a single message. And this coming leadership election is going to be incredibly divisive. And I think the result is going to be one side will win, whether it's the centre ground of the Tory party or the right. And it's going to be unlikely that they're going to be able to win significant political support among the wider electorate, because although they might gain back, you know, those voters from the Lib Dems or Labour, or those voters from Reform, I think of the visions and candidates who are likely to stand, they're unlikely to be able to win back both of those voter blocks. So, and you can already see this. You can already see this with the Tory MPs' responses to Rachel Reeves' speech today, that you have some of them and particularly the kind of Tory think tanks coming out very much in favour of Rachel Reeves' planning reforms in particular. And then you have Tory MPs saying, you know, no, this is bad. We can't have development near us. We can't have building near us. And so you've got this real divide between part of the party that wants to double down on appealing to pensioners in the UK who've been their voter base. And then you have part of the party saying, actually, the problem is we've lost young people. We've lost aspirational voters. They're completely divided. They need to unite. The question of whether they can win back power in 2029 is whether they can unite or not. On the track they're on now and on the likely course of the leadership election now, I don't think they can.
Uniting usually requires leadership. Talk about the Tory bench for a minute, the Conservative Party. Look, there's not a charismatic Boris Johnson, whatever you think about him. He was charismatic. People were drawn to him and against him. You don't really have a Rishi Sunak. You don't have whatever Liz Truss was. We'll talk about that some other time. Who's on that bench right now that's going to get any kind of a plurality of these folks to follow them? Because this sure looks like it's going to be somewhat of a sectional fight, at least for the foreseeable future, the next few months.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're looking more at the centre ground candidates, you've got Tom Tugendhat, who stood in 2022 in that leadership election that Liz Truss ultimately won. He was in the army previously. He's a moderate, what we call a One Nation Conservative centre ground Tory politician. We've also got someone like James Cleverly, who was Home Secretary until the Tories lost on Thursday. He's quite a good speaker. He's quite popular with the party. And then if you're looking more towards the right, you've got Suella Braverman, who was Home Secretary until last year. She was sacked in the end, but she was very much a hardliner on immigration, wanted to leave the European Convention on Human Rights. So she's a candidate who's almost certainly going to put herself forward. You've got Robert Jenrick, who was immigration minister until last year. He resigned in protest at the government's lack of action on reducing immigration. He's likely to put himself forward. I think he's the most likely to present himself as a kind of uniter and trying to pitch himself halfway between the centre ground and the right. He sort of comes across as a bit of a David Cameron type, but he's also able to do the kind of policy talk that kind of appeals to the right of the Tory party. And then you've also got Kemi Badenoch, who was business secretary, who's kind of similar to Suella Braverman in a lot of ways, kind of hardline, Thatcherite, socially conservative. The downside of her is she's very brittle. She doesn't come across that well in interviews. She can be quite rude, particularly with journalists. I'm not sure she would be a very effective leader of the opposition. I think probably she would be one of the front runners, though, because she's a big favourite with the Conservative base. If I had to bet now on the final two that will go to the Tory members, assuming the system doesn't change, then I would say it's probably going to be Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick.
Over. Chakrala joining us. Let's talk about these other parties really quickly. The only people that had a worse night than the Tories was the SNP, who almost had themselves an extinction level event. Where do you even start with that hot mess? And for folks that don't know, look, this was coming. They've had financial scandal. They've had leadership scandal. There was a lot of discontent. I don't think anybody thought 80% of them would go running to the Labor Party, though. I don't think folks saw that one coming. Where do they go now? Because you talk about the Tories being in the wilderness trying to find out. I mean, one person who I will admit from Scotland, who's very much for an independent Scotland, said that killed independence for at least a generation. They think it's that bad. Is it that bad?
Yeah, I think it is. It is, absolutely. And part of this is self-inflicted, because the SNP has had these big legal scandals and these big investigations over party money not going where it was supposed to. The husband of Nicola Sturgeon, the former First Minister of Scotland, was investigated by the police for potential embezzlement. So they've had all those scandals going on. And at the same time, the Labour Party has become much more popular in the country. And I think in Scotland, just as in much of the rest of the UK, there has been this increasing kind of feel of, we just need to get the Tories out. And actually, if that means voting Labour, then I'll vote Labour, even if I support independence or I don't. And actually, Scotland is the one bit of the country where you can say Labour actually did win this election rather than the other parties losing. Labour's vote share is up, I think, about 15 percentage points in Scotland. They've gained an enormous amount of support from the SNP. But also, the SNP, you know, have been in power in Scotland in the devolved administration there, the Scottish Parliament. They've been in power there for, 16, 17 years, absolutely ages. So they're facing similar problems to the problems that the Tories have faced, you know, tired, run out of ideas, struggling with the aftermath of COVID and being blamed for lots of the problems with public services. And so I think there's just a feel that there needs to be fresh leadership. And I think Scottish independence is probably dead for at least a generation now, because it seems like the SNP are on the way out. Labour definitely aren't going to put it forward. And when they go forth to the next set of Scottish elections in a couple of years' time, that's, I would almost certainly say that Labour will win that, and the SNP will lose what political power they have left.
Amazing turn of events. Lib Dems had themselves a very good evening. 72 seats. You know, it's a minority, but it's a minority that will have to be negotiated with. They'll have their say. They're going to get PMQs. They're very organized. They're very competent. They don't do anything crazy. If things start kind of getting sideways, you could see in the next by-elections, maybe they pick up some stuff just for being kind of competent and steady. If everybody else, because we know the Labour's not going to keep all 412. There's just no way. That's too much, right? Maybe they can pick up some more. They seem to be in a pretty good spot considering where they've been historically.
Yeah, and one thing to watch out for is the Liberal Democrats are really strongly, strongly against planning reform. They are one of the biggest NIMBY parties in the UK. They've essentially sabotaged the Boris Johnson government's attempts to reform planning when they won a by-election on an anti-housing, anti-development campaign back in 2021. I would expect they will be one of the leading voices against Labour's push for growth through planning. And exactly as you say, when there are by-elections, I would expect the Lib Dems to do well in them on the back of local opposition to house building. The Liberal Democrats, the big reason they've done well really is again, the efficiency of their votes. They've appealed to kind of middle-class people on the left of the Tory party. Again, a big uniting factor is a lot of them are against house building and against development. But also, this has meant that the Liberal Democrats have won 72 seats, as you say. That's their best result as the Liberal Democrats, because they used to be called the Liberal Party long ago in the midst of time, but their best results in their current form. And again, they've won basically the same percentage of the vote they won in 2019 when they only got 11 seats. So very similar to Labour, the efficiency of their votes and the structure of our voting system has really benefited them at this election.
Yep, elections are still gone off the map a lot. It's very interesting. All right, on his eighth try, Nigel Farage is finally in Parliament. He's got a little bit of company with the Reform Party, who picked up a couple of seats. Which is it? Is the reform on the upswing, or did Nigel, is he the puppy that finally caught the truck, got what he always wanted, and now may not know exactly what to do with it now that he's in the MP and is going to have a couple of restraints or at least some attention off of that? Where does all that go going forward, do you think?
I think reform are here to stay. I mean, the one thing that Nigel Farage is really, really good at is getting publicity. And because of our laws on equal coverage of political parties, particularly with regards to the BBC, the fact that Reform's won so many votes and actually won seats in a way that UKIP, Nigel Farage's previous party, didn't really manage to do, means that they will get a lot of continuing media coverage. I think Nigel Farage is going to be absolutely everywhere in this parliament. It's going to be all over the news. It's going to be causing lots of trouble. And I think Reform are really waiting in the wings, really waiting for the Tory party to collapse. Because if the Tories can't present a case for returning to power in 2029, then Reform can increasingly present a case as well. We're the right-wing party. We're the party that you should be voting for if you're a small C conservative. And so I think Reform's mission over the course of this parliament is to actually overtake the Tories, to become the opposition to the Labour Party in 2029, to become the party that can say, well, we are the main opposition. We're polling second to the Labour Party. Come and vote for us. And I think, you know, I don't like the man, but if there's anyone who would be able to do it, then it probably is Nigel Farage.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about vote share. Their vote share was actually higher than the Lib Dems. They got like 14-some percent, even though they only got a few seats. So maybe they weren't as efficient. We've been talking about voting efficiency. They may be not as efficient as the bigger party, but maybe they can learn to do that. That's the question, though. We know Nigel Farage is an instigator. We know he's a fire starter. Can he put together an actual functioning party that goes out and wins seats, especially now that the map has changed a little bit? Or can he bring in, probably more specifically, can he bring in people to actually build out a party that's not just a reactionary party, but a functional political party? And I'm not insulting anybody here. It's like, look, if you're going to win 100 seats in parliament or more, you're going to have massive infrastructure. You've got to really know what you're doing. Can he do that? That is really more of the question, because we know he can go on TV and throw bombs and get attention and get political attention. Can he do that part of it or partner with people to do that? That's the question.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they've got 63,000 members now. They've got a lot of money backing them. And I think the fact that it's almost helped Reform that they've only won a few seats. You know, there were some polls beforehand saying they were going to win 15 or 20 seats. I think that would have been more of a problem for them, because they then would have had a lot of totally inexperienced candidates in parliament. There have been all these problems with the fact that they haven't vetted their candidates properly, and a lot of kind of dodgy backgrounds for a lot of these candidates. But really, of the seats they've won five seats. Nigel Farage is one of those. He's, you know, a veteran political figure in the UK. You've got Lee Anderson, who has been an MP for 5 years previously. And you've got Richard Tice, who is the former leader of Reform UK. So the fact that they're not likely to have lots of infighting within the parliamentary party is really going to help, I think, deflect attention from the fact that Reform aren't a particularly coherent political vehicle. In a lot of ways, their manifesto at this election, you know, was pledging massive tax cuts and spending increases. It was completely insane. But I think the thing about Nigel Farage is, you know, you mentioned that distinction between actually being able to deliver and, you know, present a coherent vision and be a leader of a political vehicle and a political party. You mentioned the distinction between that and being able to appear all over the media and having all those appearances. Actually, for Farage, it's sort of one and the same thing, because the fact that he gets so much coverage and the fact that he's so good at that coverage sort of distracts attention from the fact that he's not, that Reform isn't a coherent political vehicle, or that there's all this chaos in the background. And actually, unless or until you're in government, it's kind of easy to sweep that aside if you're a charismatic enough politician with a solid enough base of support. It was similar with UKIP. I think it's even more the case with Reform UK.
Yeah, I just wonder, and that's why I said puppy catching the truck, because as long as you're, look, with only a few seats in the voter share he's got, he's going to have a lot of political capital to make a lot of noise now, because they're not going to be taking the really hard votes. They're not going to have to put together a coalition. They're not going to have to sit in a room and get, you know, 65% of whatever they wanted and pass it so that they can get something passed. They don't have to do any of that right now. The thing is, are you going to be if you want to overtake the Conservative Party, you know, we're told endlessly the oldest political party in the world, and they say it in the accent, so it sounds a lot better than when I say it, but you get the idea. If you want to be that eventually, or are you just going to be, you know, with all due respect, are you just going to be the separatists in Quebec who don't actually want to get power because then it ruins your entire reason for being, right? That's kind of the danger here. You can make a lot of money. You can make a comfortable living. You can be in political power for a very long time just being the opposition. Are they actually going to take that step? I know we don't have that answer, but I think that's the fascinating thing, especially if the Conservatives kind of stay in disarray for the next few weeks.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. But I think ultimately Farage, is the eternal opponent. He likes causing chaos. He likes being the center of attention. I don't think he cares whether he's doing that in government or whether he's doing that in opposition, so long as the focus of attention is on him. So I think it really remains to be seen. As you say, we don't have the answer to that question yet, but I think either way, he's going to cause chaos. Either way, he's going to be at the center of events. And either way, I think he's going to be pretty happy with that. And I think I don't think he ultimately really cares about the fate of the rights of politics in the United Kingdom, so long as he's the leading figure, so long as all the focus and media attention is on him, and so long as he's getting his regular appearances to spout off about what he believes the direction of the country should be.
Yeah, that's the good, bad, and indifferent. Nigel Farage, really well said. As a way to wrap all this up, I appreciate your time, Jack Rowley, getting really in depth on this UK election stuff. You know, the big traditionally, usually the UK is a little slow to change. They like to give their governments a second term just automatically, but you already brought it up. This is a much swingier, I love that term. You need to go copyright that in the UK, go get some merch made up. This is a swingier electorate. Do you think you get the full 5 years?
I think because of the scale of the majority, I think even if Labour lose a lot of support, it's still going to be the full 5 years. I don't think there's any prospect of an election much before then, especially because I think if you look at it both ways, if Labour are unpopular in a few years' time, they're very unlikely to call an early election. But also, even if they're doing the right things and they've got a path to restoring that popularity, actually, a lot of the things they've promised, a lot of the core tenets of their push for growth are things that will take 5 years, possibly even longer, to see real tangible benefits from. So they really need to stretch out this parliament for as long as they possibly can so that they can say back, return to voters and say to them, you know, we've done what we said we're going to do. We're on the right path. The economy's growing again. You've got more money in your pocket. Things are good. Vote for us.
Yeah, we all agree that this is probably an inflated majority. What do you think would be a reasonable, a little bit of a plateauing fall off, but still show that Labour's really good? What do you think their seat count should be when we start looking down the road a little bit? What's kind of the benchmarks we're going to be watching for their political success? Not just the policies, not just building stuff, but as they start going into the next election cycle and as the Tories try to rebuild and everybody else adjusts. What are they looking at here? They want to keep a majority, but what do you think would be electoral success in the next few years for them?
Well, I think any majority at all would be a success in 2029, really. You've got to remember that Labour have only won a full second term in office once before, and that was under Tony Blair. So for Keir Starmer to be able to do that in any form would be a phenomenal achievement, really. I think what Labour will be looking at over the next few years is not so much the share of the vote they're on, but the difference between their vote share and the vote share of the second largest party, whether that's the Tories or Reform, because actually they're, you know, what, 11 points ahead of the Tories at this election. If they can maintain that kind of margin, even if they don't broaden their electoral base much, then they're still going to win potentially an election victory on a similar scale in 2029. Labour have been quite lucky over the past 4 or 5 years in terms of their political opponents have become increasingly divided. If we think that their political opponents and the right of British politics is going to remain divided over the course of this parliament and that they're only going to win if they unite, then actually the odds are in Labour's favour in 2029, even if they're a fairly unpopular government.
On a bit of a lighter note, is there enough seats on that side of the parliament for this majority? Just physically, can they get everybody on that side of the room?
Well, no, there aren't. No, they're going to have to stand. This is exactly what happened under Tony Blair as well, and they want a similar number of seats. And yeah, they're all overflowing. The whole parliamentary building is falling apart, and it's not really fit for purpose anyway. But yeah, no, they're flooding all over the place.
It's funny to watch it because if you've ever been to the U.S. Capitol, how big, you know, we have a much smaller Congress. You guys have 600 some odd seats. We only have 435. And it's probably four times the size room, just the House of Representatives. That's not even counting the Senate. It's amazing. Like, we're literally joking, like, they're having their entire parliament in our gallery. It's insane to watch on TV. Something to watch for. There's going to be some competition for those, even the backbench seats. I think that's pretty amazing. Jack Rowlett, we asked you hard stuff and deep stuff on this stuff for an hour, and you hit it all. Well done, my friend. Let folks know where they can keep up with you and see you until we get you back on Hurtel again.
Yeah, great. Well, you can find me on X at Jack_nostalgic, and I'm on Substack, ottersandinsights.substack.com.
Yep. I subscribe to Otters and Insights. You should too. Jack Nostalgic's an interesting name for a guy that wants to talk housing policy, but what do you do? My friend, I greatly appreciate the time. Great insight, great conversation. Look forward to doing it again soon, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, sir. Welcome back to Herd Tell. I love covering UK politics for a couple of reasons. One is you learn a little bit different system. Two is they're an important ally. We've already talked about that. I just find their system fascinating. What I was joking with Jack at the end there that they don't, the way their parliament is set up, if you've never watched PMQ on Wednesday mornings in US time, I highly recommend you do it. The prime minister and the opposition leader ask each other questions. Of course, it's all speech written now, but you get the idea. Their opposing parties face each other in the parliament room. They're not going to have enough seats on one whole side now for all the people that are in the Labour Party because they got so many seats. It's fun to watch other people's governments work. And it's interesting, since from the parliamentary tradition, even though they were a monarchy and we were rejecting George III and all that, this is a genesis of how a lot of our government worked. It came from the parliamentary system. And our founding fathers said, okay, we like some of that, but there's parts that we want to tweak. We don't want to have a parliamentary system. We're going to have this bicameral democratic republic thing and give it a whirl. And it's worked pretty good. But whether it's a parliamentary system or a democratic republic system or representative democracy or whatever else you're running, it all rises and falls on leadership. Political parties, you can talk about the policies and stuff. The Tories got wiped out because there was a perception with a whole lot of evidence that their leadership was not good. They had chaos in their party. They had chaos in their optics. They had chaos in their policies, and they got punished severely for it. Labor looked like the better option, looked a little more stable. So they won in a landslide. If Labor descends into chaos, they will get punished again. The SNP got really hammered by voters, and mostly because of scandals. They had leadership problems. They have financial scandal, and they got punished for it. No matter where you are in the world, if the leadership looks tawdry, if you have an electoral system at all, you're going to get punished for it. And the only way you don't get punished for bad leadership is to have a dictatorship, a tyranny. And we see that with plenty of examples all around the world where people win with 97, 98% of the vote, maybe 93 like Putin did if he really wants to be magnanimous about it and try to make it look good. These things are universal. Leadership comes ahead of good policy. You got to have leadership to get good policy implemented. And you can have the best policy in the world, but if you have bad leadership, it ain't going to matter because you ain't going to be in power very long unless you want to be a tyrant. And then you got a whole other set of problems. How government work is important. How the nuts and bolts of how that functions is important. And watching it in other countries should give us some lessons on what to do and what not to do in our own country, especially in an election year where not very many people are really happy with their options here in America. But we still got to try to figure out to do something because you can't just do nothing. Well, you can, but it'll be a mess. That'll do it for Herd Tell. Have you watching or listening, we sure do appreciate you. We didn't do any YouTube for about a week and a half because YouTube gave us a strike. It was ridiculous. This was actually content that has been up for a couple of years. We migrated the podcast platform, some of the old stuff, to the YouTube channel to streamline it. It re-upped some of the old stuff, and for some reason, it was all of a sudden not good enough for their standards and their AI. They wouldn't let us appeal it. It's ridiculous, so I couldn't upload anything for about a week. We've gotten that straightened out now, but that buries the lead. The entire podcasting archive of Herd Tell, almost 700 episodes in the podcasting format, are now on YouTube, which means they're also available on YouTube Music. A lot of people listen to podcasts on YouTube, even though it's a video platform. I do it all the time. So if you want to listen to the podcast on YouTube, you can. Every single episode we've ever done and all the new ones will go on there immediately as soon as we release them. iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, any of the major platforms. We're even on minor ones. We're on some in England. We're on some over in India that I can't even really pronounce. We're on all of them. Put in Herd Tell Show. Put in my name, Andrew Donaldson. Should pop right up. Make sure you're leaving us a rating and a comment if possible, if they give you that option. It's really important. Let's other people know our program is worth checking out. also lets those platforms know that we're worth supporting and boosting up when they go to do their little algorithmic magic. We don't advertise. If you could put us on your own social media, we would really appreciate it. Outside of our social media, that's all we do. We don't do paid advertising. We would really appreciate it. Let folks know Herd Tell is a good place to go. If you don't want to listen to yelling, you want to listen to conversation and talk about what's going on in the world, we will be here and we'll keep being here as long as you keep listening and watching. So wherever you and yours are across the street or around the world, we hope you're well. We hope you are well fed. And we'll talk to you again real soon for more Herd Tell. All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.